Amanda, thank you for meeting with me. I know that we're posting this on a number of places, including Open UK, so most people will know who you are because of where it's going to be posted, but I still would love for you to talk about what Open UK is.
So Open UK is a non-traditional industry organization for the business of open technology. And I say non-traditional because we sort of broke the model on how geographic organizations in open source software and open technology work. And we turned it on its head. We brought open source software, open hardware, and open data together into the three opens into one place. And we define those as open technology. We focus not in the way that most geographic organizations do on a membership structure and businesses. So we are very much about the business of open technology, but we focus on people. And what that means is that we bring together the people who work in this space. There's a GitHub figure from October last year that shows 2.8 million GitHub accounts in the UK. The nearest in the EU is 2 million in Germany. So we're not saying there's 2.8 million developers, but there's 2.8 million GitHub accounts. It gives you an idea of the scale of interaction around collaborative working and open source and open technologies that there is here in the UK. And we don't have that big a population. You know, we're looking at 4.85, 4.9% of the population having GitHub accounts according to that. It's huge. And what we decided to do, obviously not knowing those figures, was to look at people. Because we know that a lot of the folk in the UK who work in these spaces don't necessarily work for UK companies. Now, we of course really care about homegrown startups, scale-ups, businesses that come out of the UK, but we wanted to bring everyone together. And by bringing that community together, we focus on the leaders. There's only so much interaction we can have, and they bring their communities with them. And we create this, this voice that's for the whole ecosystem, we hope. And in turn, that allows us to have influence. And we want to have influence, and we want to have influence on laws and policies and education. So, our second pillar, our first is this community piece, bringing everyone together. The second is law and policy. We respond to legislation, we take policy initiatives. We've done a lot around sustainability and open technology. We've been involved with Gaia-X in Europe, done all sorts of different things under the policy guise. And then the third is education. And we, as I'm sure we'll talk about, are putting a kind of festival of open source type conference together in a couple of weeks' time. But that's part of our educational work. We have a MOOC, a massive open online course that we're working on for students that we hope will be freely available, actually, with some of the conference content. And then I think one of the first things that we came to people's attention with was a kids camp. And we did two kids camps during lockdown when so many young people were stuck at home. And we thought we brought some fun education around open source into their lives.
One of the things that's impressed me about Open UK is the government-related work. I do want to get to the other things, but I would love for you to talk a bit more about what's being done in sustainability and I believe even energy-related as well.
So we've got a few different things going on. With COP26 being held in the UK 2 years ago now, it doesn't feel that long ago, 18 months ago, we had a focus across the UK on what was going on with sustainability. It really focused hearts and minds, as they say. We looked at open technology, and I'd been the chair of an advisory group for the UN on open source software and IP for their labs, which sadly closed during lockdown, but which were really quite innovative. And they had a very open source first approach, and they still do at the UN. And what I realized in doing that work is the correlation between the Sustainable Development Goals, which aren't just about climate action. And I say just because climate action is massive and it's important and I'm fully behind it, but it's one of many things in a big holistic picture that makes up sustainability. And when I looked at that, I realized that it aligned so closely to the principles and the values of open source and open technology. And a lot of the stuff that we do, allowing collaboration, allowing sharing, allowing recycling and reuse of code, making data accessible on the open data side so that people are able to understand things better and make energy savings. You know, if they understand how the population uses their energy supply, it allows better provision. So there's all sorts of stuff around that that made me really conscious that there was a need to elevate the status of open technology in that sustainability agenda. And I think part of it is when you look at emerging markets, they're going to leapfrog us in technology as they advance. But also the adoption of open source there is critical. They don't have to go through the years of proprietary that we did. They can, you know, take advantage of where we've got to. So I do think it's absolutely critical. And I think there's a second thing, which is the fact that we have worked for a couple of decades now, learning how to collaborate and bring businesses together to collaborate is something that is deeply and sadly missing in the sustainability agenda. So many people want to help and are doing good work, but there's so much repetition and duplication that it in itself is a waste of resource. So I think there's a lot that sustainability movement can learn from the open technology movement. So within Open UK, we focused on COP26. We had the most amazing event. We were given by Federated Hermes an incredible space. It was one of the best fringe spaces at COP26. And we were given this whole venue. We just had a jamboree. We had a whole day around sustainability. And we delivered a blueprint. And Christian Perino, who was our chief sustainability officer for the first 2 years, led that blueprint on the data center of the future. And we built a model for a data center, pulling together open source software, open hardware, open data, giving people options and choices, but building this this blueprint that could be used by others and would help them identify the different aspects of sustainability. And we worked with lots of different people on it, but the information we were given is that you could potentially reduce something like a data center's carbon emissions by over 70% by moving to open source software. Part of that is the kind of technology that's available around containerization. Part of it is once you've done that, moving to open hardware models and, you know, sharing the specifications. But you could take a room and just reduce right down the amount of kit that was needed, and therefore reducing the amount of heat generated. And of course, when you've done that, there's still heat generation. And we were looking at putting it back into the community, you know, either subsidizing people's heating with it, which, you know, at the moment when we're all struggling with heating bills is really important, or do things for the community as a whole, like heating swimming pools, perhaps creating the warmth for greenhouses and growing, you know, community gardens, that kind of thing. We even looked at the Eden project, which was opening in Dundee, and the possibility of heating something like that in the community with it. And what we were looking at was edge-based. It was very high-tech. It was very, you know, of the moment, moving the data center closer to the end user, reusing and recycling redundant stock from the pandemic. So I think it was very much of its moment. And actually, initially, we gave it to the Eclipse Foundation, but we've decided that we want to build on these blueprints. So at our conference on the 7th and 8th of February, Chris Lloyd-Jones, who is at Avanade and who's come on board as our blueprint officer, an amazing guy. He takes a day off work a week to work with us pro bono. Chris is leading on that, and he's going to resurrect our data center blueprint. He's going to launch this EV charging blueprint, electric vehicle charging blueprint. We've worked very closely with the Open Charge Alliance on that around open standards. And we're going to look at what other blueprints we can do, perhaps run a competition for others so that they can start to use this blueprint model now that we know it works. And Chris's role is really going to be to focus on community. We were also, I believe, the first open technology, open source organization to have a chief sustainability officer and put a sustainability policy in place. And that was Christian Perino, who has served his 2 years. He's an old colleague of mine from Canonical and said he would do 2 years, which he's done. And I'm delighted that he has been replaced by a lady called Leanne Kemp, who runs an organization called Everledger. She's a founder. She's currently this week at Davos, where she's speaking. People use the term force of nature about me sometimes. I'm never sure what I think about that, to be honest, but they do. And to me, Leanne is a force of nature. You know, she's just incredible, the amount the woman achieves. But I think she will bring a very different approach and a different viewpoint on it. And something we'd started last year and not finished was looking at societal value metrics. So we work very hard to look at the economics of open source and to try and demonstrate the value that it brings to society economically. But there's a whole raft of values that it also has that are aligned to the sustainable development goals that aren't about money and economics. And we're trying to focus in on them and find a set of measures that can be used so that we can look at the individual projects and give them a scoring against that. So that's something we're going to keep working on. And I know we are going to talk about the conference that's just about to come up, but we will have another sustainability event in Edinburgh on the 14th of September.
I do want to get to the conference, but I'm still going, I'm going to hold you off more because I want to talk to you about the book that you recently edited. I believe there's a chapter written by you as well in there. I often have over the years have said to people
you don't believe it. You read it for me before it was published. You know it was there.
Yes, I do. I almost said that. I did read it.
Take the credit for helping.
I did read it. And what was interesting about the book is that for years I've said to people that you know more about open source than anyone that I knew, but even that I knew of. What was the driving force for the book?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the book took 5 years. I'll try not to sit and complain for the next 5 minutes about how awful editing a book is. And it is awful. But 5 years before it was published, so in 2017, my former professor, who actually isn't that much older than me, Ian Walden, had edited a first version of the book, which I had contributed to a decade ago when I knew much less about open source. And Ian is somebody who isn't, you know, massively involved in open source the way I have been. And I was trying to persuade him to do a new edition because I felt it was needed, because things have just moved so fast and so far. If you look at where we were when I joined Canonical in 2008, you know, trying to persuade people to take open source into their organizations, and you look at today where the majority of software is open source, where every organization is open source, the world, you know, has revolved at such a pace, and that the pace of adoption in open source over the last decade has just been almost immeasurable. It's been so fast. So there needed to be a new book, and there were lots of things I was aware of that hadn't been covered in the first one that I would like to have been. So I tried to talk him into doing it, and he, having done it before, knew how much work it was and said to me, no, he wasn't doing it. And I went off, and the easy bit was going off to all these amazing people I know and asking them to contribute. So there are 26 authors, I think, and 24 chapters. Obviously, one of them's me, but 25 others. And I'd forgotten what it's like, you know, when you're trying to get really busy, really bright people who do a lot to do something. They are like herding cats. And a lot of them are lawyers, which makes it even more like herding cats. So it took a bit of time. They all agreed to do it. There's only one person who said they wouldn't do it and one person who didn't deliver. And they both told me how much they regret having made those decisions now that they look back on it. But they've all delivered. I'll be public about this. I have ADHD, and trying to edit other people's work that's between 10 and 15,000 words a chapter, and there's 24 of them, was not the easiest thing I've ever done. So at points I was a bit slow in getting it done, but we got it over the line. And I think that the purpose of it is that it is an absolutely necessary text, because we look at a society today where we rely on everything being digital. And because it's digital, it's defined by open source software. You know, it's software defined digitalization, which is built in open source software. And very few people really understand what that means. It's very niche. You know, I always laugh when you say I know more about open source than anyone, you know, because I'm sure I don't. But beyond that, how many people know anything about it? And that's one of the big issues. We've seen this incredible pace of adoption, but we've not seen the discipline that goes with that in understanding that you're taking something you've been given for free, that is not for a particular purpose, and you're using it in that use case and that purpose. And you really have to think about how you're going to do it and what is it you're using. Does it have a healthy community? Does it have a single vendor who is supporting it, you know, where you might actually almost end up back in a situation with proprietary code and a lock-in type situation, or there won't be people to maintain it. And maintaining the code is such a big issue. And making sure that you yourself have the right skills and you interact with the communities and you give back to them so that you are part of this whole ecosystem. So a lot of that stuff, I think people needed information on. I can't imagine, it's 640 pages long. I can't imagine many people will ever go and read it from one end to the other. One or two people have told me they are, and I'm deeply suspicious of those people. But it's well indexed. Are we trying to make it well indexed? And of course, it's open access, because I don't think we could have published a book about open technology that wasn't. So it's open access for non-commercial purposes and available through Oxford University Press and my own website, amandabrock.com. You'll find it very easily to download and search the index for the bits that you want, or pick out chapters. And my piece, as you know, because you read it for me, Chris, is on revenue generation and commercialization.
Living in a startup world and in a tech world, that I have come into contact with many a person who greatly misunderstands open source and particularly greatly misunderstands open source licensing and even the core values of open source. So having a reference guide, not a how-to, but a reference guide.
That point you're making about the people not understanding it, that is so true. And I think that for me, I had a very odd introduction in that I drifted into open source by taking a job. I was only meant to be there 3 months and I stayed 5 years as I became the general counsel at Canonical, the head lawyer, and I set up their legal team. And it was a very early stage, at least in Europe, in open source, and I think pretty much anywhere. So I had the privilege of learning from a bunch of developers. You know, there weren't many lawyers. I did most of the work and had a couple of people join me over time. So I had to do things and learn, and I saw a lot of stuff. So I probably had a broader vision than most lawyers ever get. There are very few lawyers who have worked in a true open source organization for that long. There are those, but there are very few, and who are commercially minded, because what I was doing a lot of was commercial transactions. You know, we did a deal with Dell where in my first few weeks, where I think it was the first operating system, the first open source operating system to be distributed on a preloaded on an individual device, on a desktop, on a laptop.
So the conference, the event,
the festival of open source.
Well, so I want to really break down the different pieces, because this is from being produced by Open UK, and yet not only do you have me coming from San Francisco, I've talked to people who are at least throughout the US and Europe who are planning to attend. So it clearly is not the state of open source in the UK. It is the state of open source at this point. You'd mentioned education earlier, but I believe it goes well beyond that. Can you give me first an understanding of what will be covered, what the focus of the conference is?
Yeah. So I wanted to build a conference that brought a conversation that I was seeing happen in small rooms with a few people to a much broader audience. And one of the beauties and one of the things that really attracts me to open source is the way that it's for all of us. And it's collaborative, and it's about communities. And I'm always being picked up on that word community, because it means different things to different people. And for me, the community is vast, and some of it is individuals, some of it's organizations, and it's everybody who's part of our ecosystem, whatever form they take. And I love the fact that we collaborate and we work together. And although I'm paid in a role, I do way more than I'm paid for. And I do lots of things beyond it because I choose to, because I'm part of that community. And it's really important to me. And I wanted to open up a conversation that I think is critical. And we touched on the fact that open source has become the norm, but it's become the norm in a world that doesn't necessarily understand it terribly well. And if it's not nurtured and cared for, it will be broken. And what will happen if it's broken is that we will keep some of the bits of it, but inevitably we'll return to a world that lacks open source and is filled with proprietary software. And we've already seen it doesn't work. It's not the best way to do things. And I want to work to make sure that we don't take that step back. And in order to do that, we need to build education about how open source is used, but we also need to address some fundamental issues. And the US government are pretty much ahead of the curve here. The White House executive order from May 2021 is something that tackled security. It wasn't specific to open source, but had a good chunk in it about open source. And it was the first time I had seen anywhere where there was a piece of legislation that was done so well and used the right language and addressed some of the right issues. And it focuses on SBOMs and supply chain, software bill of materials and supply chain, and understanding what code you're using and dependencies, all of which is stuff that we were doing in Canonical because you had to when you were, you know, you were providing open source to commercial customers. So, and even that statement I just made could confuse, because you're not providing the open source to commercial customers. You're providing services around open source software that they've taken from a repository to commercial customers. And there's lots of nuance about it. And that nuance and understanding is so important. And making sure that we have software that is secure, that is well maintained, and that we have the skills and resources to maintain it is really important. And because the software is now in this digitalized world providing our infrastructure, not just in the enterprise, but in the public sector, it's suddenly on the government's agenda where they see that there are risks, not just in open source, but in all software. There are security risks. You know, all software has vulnerabilities. All software is at risk of bad actors, but you're not going to undigitalize or de-digitalize our world. So we have to learn how to deal with that. And open source presents with its own set of challenges, and those have to be met. So we have to work out how we make our society and our public sectors and the services government provides secure, and how we do that through our digital environments. So what we've seen with the White House is first steps from them. I'm incredibly proud to say that there are two women directors coming from the White House, or an assistant director and a deputy director, who are in this cybersecurity and technology space. So it's just going to be really fantastic to have them part of this conversation. And we will have a public conversation with several hundred people in a room with those people. And that's exactly what I wanted to achieve. So, you know, I've achieved my first goal, assuming that there are several hundred people in the room, which is the next bit I need help with. You know, we've built it, so please come. But that's the base point. Then we will split into seven plenaries, in fact, eight, where SustainOSS has just come on board to have their own conference within a conference, and we have an unconference within a conference. We then have six tracks where there'll be the deep technical engineering stuff with Liz Rice hosting a day and a half of sessions around platform engineering. You know, forget DevOps, we're all platform engineering these days. And we have another, Sal Kamich is leading a room on security. And that security room, if I tell you that I've got Eric Brewer speaking in it from Google, I've got Guy Pajani, the founder of SNCC, I've got Sarah Novotny from Microsoft. You know, the list of, I've got the White House, the list is endless of the incredible people who are there. So on a technical level, there are two really good tracks that would be worth attending either or both of. If you, you know, if you just wanted to go to an engineering conference, then we have a government law and policy track. It's a bit of a mishmash of stuff, and it runs from OSPOs to community policies to curation of software, which is part and parcel of how you use it well. So it's not just about security, it's about a lot of different things, a lot about governance, about good hygiene, good technical hygiene. So all of those kind of topics, standards, will be covered in that room. And then the fourth room that will cover open source software is the entrepreneurship room, and we will have up to 20 founders each hosting a table. They will sit with the delegates at these tables, and we will have 45-minute workshops on things like product development, community building and contribution, how you generate revenue when you've given away your assets, how you scale, how you raise money. So there'll be a 45-minute panel session, and then there'll be a 45-minute discussion at the tables with the founders. And this will be unprecedented access to founders that's never been seen in a conference before. And then we've got two other areas, because I've mentioned open technology as opposed to open source software. And we have an open data room run by our friends and partners at the Open Data Institute. They're 10 years old, founded by Sir Tim Berners-Lee. Great people we work a lot with, and an open hardware room hosted by Eric Riedel. So we cover that whole span, but that isn't enough. You know, there's nothing like organizing your first conference and taking on more than you need to. So one of the things I noticed traveling to conferences last year, and I spent about 6 months back on the road, was that people wanted to be together. So one of the first things I went to was in Valencia, and it was KubeCon. And I was really surprised by how many talks I went to. I don't think I've ever been to as many talks. And people wanted to be in the talks. They wanted to learn. They were worried about what they'd missed. Most people, like me, don't like digital learning. But then there was this thing also where they wanted time together and they wanted to meet new people. And a lot of us, even those who are quite involved in the communities around open source, haven't met people because there's been changes. There's new people joined, people have moved around. And it's a great way to, you know, it's always been the way we've worked, right? We sit, we work at home, most of us, occasionally go to an office, and then we all meet up at conferences. So there is a circuit, there's a regular, you know, most people go to one or two a year, some go to a lot more, but there's a regular engagement through those conferences. There's people like Nithya Ruff at AWS, who I see a lot at conferences, and we're good friends. We've become good friends over a decade. And I find out what's going on in the world from her, and she finds out what's going on in the world from me. But we've got to know each other. There was a point in time where we didn't. And Chris, it's like you and I, when we met at a conference in Lyon with Linux Foundation, and we went to a mixer event for diversity on the first night. And it allowed us to then hang out together through the conference, which we wouldn't have done without that engagement. So what I've tried to do is shift that a little bit. And instead of having, you know, 20-minute coffee breaks where you rush out, get a coffee, try and do your email, rush back in and don't speak to anyone, I've tried to structure the timing slightly differently. And I'm sure it won't be perfect and it'll work a bit and we'll have to work more on it. But we've created an hour in the morning, an hour at lunch, and an hour in the afternoon where you don't have any talks happening anywhere in the building. But we do have three, I guess using the term exhibition space makes it easier. It's not a traditional exhibition space, but it helps people understand. And across those spaces, we have 48 tables. There are no booths. Conferences like All Things Open and Scale, which I went to last year in Raleigh and in LA, had a much better engagement through tables. So what we've done is we've got the 48 tables where we've got not-for-profits and for-profits mixed in together. There's no like bad corner to be in where you stick the people who haven't paid. Everybody's equal and nobody gets to choose. We've had so many requests saying, can I be next to? And the answer is no, you'll just get what you get. So they'll all be mixed up. And then we have the interactive experiences, and we're calling it DX, delegate experience, a mixture of the opportunity to hang out on these tables and learn more. So you can speak to people like the Open Source Initiative. You can speak to the Eclipse Foundation. You can speak to Finos. And you can learn about what they do and engage in their communities. But you can also wander up to Boeing, and we love this. Boeing are going to have virtual reality headsets which do flight simulation and a space trip. So you can go and do something like that. There'll be a big screen where you can watch other people's experiences. And I can just imagine standing in the queue, standing in the line, chatting to someone next to you and finding out that there's someone you've always wanted to meet. So we've tried to create a few things around the building. We're also really conscious that this is a difficult time and an awful lot of people have been laid off. So today we issued 100 free tickets for people who are between roles for our colleagues in that situation. And we also have a job board, which is going to be hosted by a Linux job board. And they are going to be there and talk to people and try and help them. And I think that's a good thing, because at the moment, there's so many people in this situation and many of us have been through these things in the past, and it will last for a time and it will come back. So pulling together is what we need to do right now. So we have this DX thing, and I have a building that will take over 1,000 people across 5 floors, and we have a media suite. So I think we have 6 rooms with podcasters who will be doing recordings, not just of speakers, but of people who are attending the conference, get a really broad range of people. Anaïs Ulrich, who won our award, she won the individual category of our award back in November. Anaïs is a YouTuber. She's won lots of other awards for her YouTubing. So she's going to be doing that at the conference. We've got BBC Click. So there'll be a radio broadcasting by the BBC. The BBC are also providing an experiential experience. So all of these different things to participate in, to engage with, and you'll have the 3 hours that I've mentioned in the day. There's also 5:30 to 8:30 on the first day, a party for everybody. And one of the things I haven't mentioned is there is a photo exhibition that we've been working on for about 6 months of figures from open source in the UK. So there'll be a big room with that in it as well. And then we have festival tents with an open fire being built outside on the lawn overlooking the Houses of Parliament. So you can get a once-in-a-lifetime experience, I imagine, to sit in a teepee by the open fire looking at Westminster Abbey.
From someone who has had the sideline view of what is happening, and to sum up so much of what you've described, there are two things that excite me about the conference, two things in particular that I think very much speak to open source itself, which is your content. There's so much good content, so much good access that both to individuals and what either luminaries or just very smart people have to say about different areas of the of open source and about where it is today and where it's going, as well as the community part. I had a fantastic experience of when I met you of not knowing who you were and you not knowing who I was. And the fact that we both are at a certain point in our career and that we ended up then working together is fantastic. But the point was neither of us looked at the person who was across and made a judgment and decided that they would talk to them because they were a somebody. It the amount of access that people will get to both content and community and the amount that you are promoting it is not just impressive, it's important. You know, obviously security is my main passion and concern, and what is happening at this conference is so important.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. 7th and 8th of February here in London. And I appreciate it because you've had a ringsider view through it and participated and engaged and helped. And there's a couple of things we haven't covered. One is that we have the tracks and the conference content. We then have the delegate experience. And we decided this week that some of the things that we were originally throwing into that delegate experience bucket are actually amenities. So we have things like a prayer room, we have a creche, you know, people are very welcome to book into that creche and have their children looked after. And I hope they do because we're paying for it, whether they use it or not. But all those things that you might not get at a normal conference. One of the things that we haven't talked about at all yet, and we haven't really mentioned much across the media, is that for every delegate who attends the conference, we have a woodlands tree being planted for them by one of our sponsors, our sustainability sponsor here in the UK. So we can actually tell you where the trees are going to be planted and what kind of trees they are. And they'll be there to talk about it at the conference. And it's a form of offset and it's a gesture, and we'll do more over time. But we wanted to keep that sustainability agenda running through everything we do. And that's why we don't have a separate sustainability track or a separate DEI track. We've tried to consider it in everything that we do.
And I think that that in itself very much matches the community.
I hope everybody will come along and join us on the 7th and 8th of February at State of Open Con here in London. You can find it at stateofopencon.com, and you will see that tickets are at a heavily subsidized price of £199. They would normally be four or five times that, but we've organized this in association with IEEE, who are a major sponsor, headline sponsor, and a whole raft of other sponsors who've made it possible. We also have to be, you know, so thankful of all our speakers who are coming and participating in this without being paid. The other thing that I would say is if you can't make it to join us, the six tracks will be both streamed and recorded, and we will have them edited up and shared as quickly as we can. It's something like 65 hours of content, so it'll take a few weeks, but you can watch live for free. And if you just go onto the website, stateofopencon.com, you can register either to attend in person for £199 or to come along digitally. And we do have 100 tickets available for people who are currently between roles, people in our community who may not otherwise be able to attend, and some community tickets being released each day. So please just drop us a note on admin@openuk.uk if you'd like one of those.
Thank you very much. As always, wonderful to speak with you.